We're talking about the Shroud of Turin as we enter into Holy Week for millions of Christians around the world who believe that the Shroud is the actual burial cloth of Jesus Christ. And my guest, Dr. Andrew Silverman, says there is now plenty of scientific research that demonstrates the following evidence about the Turin Shroud. The image is not the work of an artist. The cloth appears to be many centuries older than the 1988 carbon dating suggested. The image seems, this is where it gets interesting. The image seems to have been formed by a short, intense burst of radiant energy brighter than the sun. Starts to sound a little bit like a resurrection event, doesn't it? And we'll get around to talking about that with Dr. Silverman as we continue to discuss the Shroud of Turin here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett. And we are back with Dr. Andrew Silverman, medical doctor. The website is lightoftheshroud.com. And Dr. Silverman, I want to talk about this radiant burst of energy brighter than the sun. Now, without getting too technical, explain what the physical evidence on the Shroud is that would account for this. How do we know that there was this radiant burst of energy brighter than the sun?
Okay. Well, it's not something that I can say that we know. What I can say is that it would be consistent with the evidence that we see on the Shroud, that it would account for, for example, the photographic negative properties of the image. Now, for example, and also it would account for the superficial, the fact that the image is only on the very thin layer in the surface fibers where the chemical change happened, because had there been such a burst of ultraviolet radiant energy, then it does get absorbed by a very small thickness of the cloth. Now, of course, the question is, what was the position of the man when it happened? And again, going back to some work that was done by Dr. Mavoy, when you look at the hair, it's hanging down. It's not on the shoulders rather than being behind him. And there's no flattening of the muscles at the back of the body. Now, many people think that that's because at least the muscles not being flattened was because there was rigor mortis. But the point is that rigor mortis, as any doctor knows, it only affects muscle. It doesn't affect the fat under the skin and so on. So you still do get flattening, even if someone did have rigor mortis. So it looks as though when the image occurred, that the body, rather than being laying flat, was actually vertical. And so people wondered, does that mean, are we trying to say he was standing up? Well, no, it doesn't look like he was standing up, because the feet are on different levels and pointing downwards. So it appears as though this man had actually been suspended above the ground. Now, this is interesting because if you look at what was written about the life of the individual known as Jesus of Nazareth, and of course, there's so much evidence pointing to the fact that this was his burial cloth. During his lifetime, he was at times reported to have his body acted as though it were didn't have weight in the ordinary sense, for example, walking on the water and at points where he was seen to rise above the ground. And also at an event that I believe is referred to as the Transfiguration, it said that he was seen to shine brightly. Now, these are things that wouldn't have been in medieval times. Looking at the cloth, people wouldn't have known that there was evidence on there of him having been upright. They wouldn't have known that there was evidence that implies that the body had shone. Now, the fascinating thing to me is to account for how such a thing could have happened. And usually people approach it from one of two ways. Either they see it as one of three ways. Either they see it as a clever forgery, but no one knows how that could have been done, or they see it as a chance coincidence of various different physical factors that meant that the dead body formed an image in some way, perhaps through chemicals coming from the body and so on. But again, this doesn't either fully account for the image, nor does it account for why this object is unique as far as we know in human history.
So what you're saying, if I could just stop you, Dr. Silverman, because I can't let this go by without sort of hammering on this point again, because this is astounding. You're saying that the image on the shroud was formed essentially while the body was levitating in a vertical position? Levitating?
Well, that's what the evidence suggests. As bizarre as it may sound, that's what we see when we look at the cloth. We see the hair hanging down on the shoulders, and we see that there's no flattening at the back. So that is consistent with that notion, yes. So another way that people try to look at this is to suggest that it's what they call a miracle, something outside of natural law. But to me, and therefore a mystery, but to me, I would always try to seek a rational understanding as much as is possible. And if we to look at the fact that the coincidence of two points, one is that this is a unique event in human history, and two, that it appears to be the image of a man who had very interesting teachings and lived in a particular way according to what he taught, for example, regarding love thy neighbor as thyself and so on. Is there perhaps some connection between mind and matter that means that living in a certain way might actually change your physical aspect? And if it's done to full extent, that it might actually have caused the body to shine. Now, I mentioned the levitation and so on. It's interesting that there's a story about when he was seen to walk on the water, that one of his friends who was there, who was just referred to as Peter, also walked on the water. And at one point he began to sink into the water because he didn't believe what was happening could be happening. Now, that's interesting because it suggests that the connection between mind and matter, that something had changed in his body as a result of his focus of mind, which then could be altered one way or the other. And what's interesting about what this individual, Jesus of Nazareth, taught is that he said that the things that you see him do, you also can do, and greater than these can you do. And that he said that nothing could be impossible to you. Now, the interesting thing about this is that he was actually, some of the things that Jesus taught were talking about things that has only been discovered by science many centuries later. For example, he referred to something known as the second law of thermodynamics when he spoke about this world being one in which everything breaks down, where there's rust and moths, and an interesting one about the thieves who break in and steal. But
the law of entropy. The law of entropy.
Yes, that's right. And also about there being sufficient of something in a mustard seed to move a mountain, which is actually in a sense, it's predicting of further discoveries that were made regarding E=mc², which of course have been used to devastating, terrible effect in the nuclear age. But he was always referring to the power of the human mind and suggesting that we could become freer, that we could change our minds, which incidentally is that's what the word repent means. It means change your mind, metanoite. That if we undo the restrictions that make us divide man from man through all the isms, if you like nationalism, racism, all the things that make people hate each other and cause division, and if we can learn to understand more of the value of every single human being and live according to that, then maybe something might change in our aspect, in our lives, that might enable us to see understand what he was talking about a bit more.
Dr. Silverman, if you're willing to consider that as a possibility, that we are all essentially beings of light, are you also willing then to consider the possibility that Jesus Christ was who he said he was, that is, the Son of God, and that he was divine?
Well, it's interesting that he said, is it not written, you are God? And he referred to his Father as our Father. So I think what he was, an example of what, if you're asking me my personal opinion, an example of what humanity is capable of, not there to make political institutions and religions out of, but to learn about humanity and what we can be and why we should value every human being as precious, whatever their background, nationality, race, beliefs, whatever. And to see that it's interesting that when people were cured after coming into contact with him, he would always say things like, "Your faith has made you whole." He would always say that it was the person themselves that had been instrumental in the change that happened. And I don't think he was trying to put himself on a pedestal, but he was trying to show humanity what humanity can achieve if we just follow his example.
All right. Are you good to take some calls, Dr. Silverman?
Certainly.
All right. We're going to go east of the Rockies. Now, this is interesting as we celebrate Passover. We've got Moses on the line from Tallahassee, Florida. Good morning, Moses.
David Charette, my brother. How you doing?
I'm well, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well as well. Well, I'm living with spinal stroke, but it's part of my journey, so I understand it now. So, whether it's so if a man think it's so easy, so I think positive and optimistic.
But that's the way to do it, my friend.
Repeat that.
I say that's the way to do it, my friend. Did you have a question or comment about the shroud?
Yes, I certainly do. For one thing, carbon dating hasn't been an accurate science. So I've been listening coast to coast since 1994 when the Spirit led me to Atlanta, Georgia. Okay, I've been listening coast to coast since 94. So I've been listening to all these shows. And they only cut off part of the shroud because they didn't want to. They only cut off this part of the so-called shroud to do the investigation. So they didn't carbon date the blood. And again, as far as the sun power, flash power, the gun power to do it, make flash images, what they've been doing back and before we got in modern technology. So that's possible to do a flash. And so Leonardo da Vinci was a great scientist. So he was very versed. He was into the occult knowledge. Plus a lot of the temple of Dendera has the electric light, you know, so they have knowledge of that. Egypt had technology, ancient lights, flying vehicles, the whole nine yards. And one other thing, they might have just taken real blood and diluted it just right to give the desired effect of the image that they want to bring forth. I think this. One other thing, the letter J did not come into the English alphabet until the 14th, 15th century. So there couldn't have been no Jesus, Jehovah, Jah, Jacob, Joseph, or none of that. So again, Dr. Silverman, could you expound on some of those, some of that, and I will take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right, Moses in Tallahassee, thank you so much. So Dr. Silverman, Moses sort of suggesting that the technology may have existed during medieval times to create this forgery. What are your thoughts?
Well, the thing is, you see, that the people often say, then there's a very interesting paper that was written by Barry Schwartz, who's who has the shroud.com website talking, and he is a photographer, so he knows what he's talking about photography. And he makes a very interesting point. Yes, we can say that all the raw materials existed in medieval times to make a photograph, but all the raw materials existed in medieval times to make a car or an atom bomb or a microwave oven. But you see, it's not enough to say that the raw materials were there. The knowledge of how to do it wasn't there, and also the fact that the distance coding in the image and so on would imply to me. I don't think as far as I know that.
Oh, you cut out again there, Dr. Silverman. I'm not sure if it's the Skype that's doing that or not. Are you with us?
Hello.
Are you there, Dr. Silverman? Yes, you cut out again. You were talking about the three-dimensional information that's encoded in the shroud, and then we lost you. So if you could back up to that.
So the three-dimensional information that's encoded in the shroud image would suggest that if the image were formed by a radiant burst of energy, that would have emanated from the body of the man rather than being reflected from external light source, so to speak. And there's very interesting things that if you look at the forensic aspect of it as well. For example, the off-image stain of the blood that had come, that we can see would have come from the elbow, while the cloth was draped around the body, which when you flatten the cloth out as it is when it's displayed, and as it appears that the cloth is as though it were flattened when the image formed, then the that blood stain is now nowhere near the image. So the notion that a forger had it would have had to apply the blood first. And also, because of the pattern that you see with the blood and the serum, it suggests to any pathologist who's looking at it that the only way that those stains could have got on there is that the shroud did once wrap the dead body of a man who had actually been crucified, rather than the blood having been painted on there, so to speak, and that the image of the body of the man in the shroud occurred at some point after the blood stains had formed.
Another interesting aspect of the shroud is, now, according to most of the accounts that we have and everything we know about Roman crucifixion, is that to hasten the death of the person being crucified, the Roman centurions who would be in attendance would break the legs of the victim so that they could not use their legs to sort of support their body. And then this would cause them to have great difficulty in breathing if they're simply hanging by their arms, essentially. Mm-hmm. And yet, the image on this shroud, there's no evidence that the legs were broken. Why is that significant?
Well, I think people, some people would say that's significant because they see it as fulfilling a prophecy that that no bones would be broken, but and that I mean, there's so many things that are significant on the shroud that point to it being having been the historical Jesus of Nazareth that the shroud once wrapped. For example, with the cap of thorns and so on. The other thing is that during most of the time when the Romans were crucifying the Judeans, they would leave them out to the elements, as a deterrent to people. This is what happens if you disobey Roman law. But there was a period between six.
Sorry, Dr. Silverman, I got to jump in here. We'll take a time out. We'll come back and pick up on that thought. The Shroud of Turin, Dr. Andrew Silverman, here on Coast to Coast AM. We are talking about this remarkable relic known as the Shroud of Turin. Dr. Andrew Silverman is with us, and we'll get back to him and your calls when Coast to Coast AM continues right after this. And we are back here on Coast to Coast AM. Richard Serrett with you, and Dr. Andrew Silverman on the line from Great Britain, talking about the Shroud of Turin. Before we get back to the calls, and they are lined up, ready to go, Dr. Silverman, let me ask you about this. Let's assume for a moment that there was a resurrection event and there was radiation emitted. Would there not be traces of this radiation still to be found in the fibers of the linen, or perhaps even in the walls of the tomb, which some say is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem?
Well, you see, it all depends on what type of radiation it is. If it's, as I'm suggesting, possibly electromagnetic in nature, then it doesn't. The evidence of it is the image. Now, had it been, for example, particle radiation with what's known as something like alpha particles and so on, and atomic changes happening, then yes, you might find, and there are some people who believe that. I think Mark Antonacci is one of them, and I presented a paper in Frascati at the conference in 2010, and he also presented one there, putting that notion forward that there was particular radiation and that there would be changes. But to me, the evidence is more consistent with a short, intense burst of electromagnetic radiant energy, in keeping with the experiments done by Dr. De Lazzaro and his team, that a similar type of intense burst of radiant energy can make similar changes to the chemical structure of the very superficial fibrils in the collagen. And apart from those changes, it wouldn't change the sort of isotopic structure of the elements at all, because it's not that type of radiation.
All right, let's go back to the phones, we'll go to the wild card line, and David is in Arkansas. David, good morning. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hey, thank you. Dr. Silverman, I was wanting to ask you two quick questions. The first one was, did they ever say what his blood type was on the turn? And the second question was, when Christ was talking to Thomas, did he not say that for him to stick his finger through the hole in his hand? And I'll take my answers off there. Thank you.
Good questions, David.
Yeah. Well, yes, there has been typing of the blood, and it appears that the man of the shroud had blood type AB. Regarding the question of what he said to Thomas, I do understand that it is reported that he said that. Of course, I'm not privy to what he actually said, but I've read that he is supposed to have said that to Thomas.
I've heard one possible explanation, and I don't know if this is true, but apparently the Hebrew word that was used in that particular passage is a word that describes not specifically the hand, but the lower half of the arm. So it could be anywhere from the elbow down. Don't quote me on that, but I'm actually seeming to recall a conversation I had with Mark Antonacci, and I believe that may have been the explanation. Let's go to the wild card line again and say hello to Mark in Oregon. Mark, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Well, thank you, Richard. I appreciate it. And hello to you and Dr. Silverman. Richard, you know, I just really, real quick, want to mention that I think you do an excellent job on the show. I've listened for a long, long time to Coast and a lot of different radio shows currently and for years, and you do an extremely good job. You're a very good broadcaster. I hope that they'll keep you in a more permanent position in the future.
I appreciate that, Mark. Thank you very much.
You betcha. You betcha. Well, it's been mentioned that his bones were not broken on the Shroud of Turin, and that's prophesied. It may be in Psalms, the Psalms of David in the Old Testament, but it's in the prophecies. And that corroborates that prophecy, and everything about the shroud actually corroborates the actual crucifixion of Jesus Christ all the way to a supernatural event portrayed on the fabric. So I think we can draw the obvious conclusion here that it is what it is, that it's only what it appears to be. It's Occam's razor applied here. When it comes to actually...
I love throwing Occam's razor back in the skeptic's face for a change. Thank you for that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We'll never know anything for sure. You know, it's like cynicism and doubt are only useful up to the point of corroborative evidence, which is indisputable. That's my motto. You have to be reasonable. Don't let the strictures of investigative processes actually inhibit one from being able to actually see the obvious conclusion. Yeah. But at any rate, what you have with the bones not being broken is that he, as it says right in the description in the New Testament of the crucifixion, that he died before they even had to break his bones to hurry his death. He only lasted about, I think it was 8 hours or a little longer. So there was a wound that the Roman soldier put up in his side at this time, if you remember, and blood and water came out, as is described in the King James Version, the Authorized King James, which I go by, really. And this is the same wound that you were speaking of with Thomas. When he said to Thomas, if you read the account, you'll see, I think it's in Acts, put your hand in my side if you doubt. And that was the same wound as, and that's the spear of Longinus that Hitler was looking for and probably found.
That's right, the spear of destiny.
Yeah,
so,
but God
which
bless
is an indication
you.
Of post-mortem bleeding, because the stain on the shroud is blood red vessels, but also serum, which is sort of the separation between of blood and the plasma, I guess. Is that not right, Dr. Silverman?
I would just like to address one point, and that's the word supernatural. And again, you see, to my way of thinking, I'm not suggesting that the image formation was a result of a supernatural event. I'm suggesting that we need to expand our notion of what nature is and understand a little bit better about the connection between mind and matter. You see, people question whether there is such a thing as mind influencing matter at all. And yet, if we do have such a thing as freedom of will, then every single moment of our lives, whenever we make a choice, then we are exercising the power of mind over matter. So, and to me, that's not supernatural. That's nature. And if you look at developments in quantum theory, for example, they have led a professor of physics at Stanford University to suggest that, it's called Andre Linder, to suggest that consciousness may actually be more fundamental even than matter itself, and that mind might not even need matter or a body in order to exist. And so I would suggest that neither is it a forgery, nor is it a supernatural event, but it's a natural event that shows us what humanity is capable of if we only free our minds and live according to the way that he showed us.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies and to Buffalo, New York, where we check in with Louis. Louis, welcome.
Good morning. It's Louis. There's three songs, Louis, and I've grown up with all of them at 63. I can't stand them anymore. Hello, Doctor. Good morning, and thank you very much for being on the show. And thank you, Richard. I have a off-the-wall question for you. It has to do with the Shroud of Turin being in a fire, and it was repaired. The nuns at the convent in France took the corner that was burnt, and actually they reworked it with cotton, and that was shipped off to Oxford University, which was paid £1 million to radiocarbon test that, and they came to the conclusion it was fake. And I'd just like to point out that they picked the wrong part of the shroud to test. Did you ever hear anything about that?
We did discuss that earlier, Louis. Perhaps you missed that part of the conversation earlier on. And Dr. Silverman, if I recall, you said that it wasn't a patch. It was simply a reweaving of a part of the cloth that they actually tested.
Yes, and I would just like to say for the record, I'm not advocating any kind of conspiracy theory or that the labs deliberately tried to get the wrong date. They may have, for all I know, they acted in good faith and dated accurately the samples that they were given, but those samples were not representative of the rest of the cloth, and it does appear. And as I said, there will be a paper being presented at the upcoming St. Louis Shroud Conference in this October of some new evidence that has come to light that will confirm the chain of evidence, the provenance of the fibers that were tested by Raymond Rogers to show that there is a discrepancy between the carbon dating area and the rest of the shroud that provides further evidence that the carbon dating date is erroneous and wrong.
All right, let's go to the international line and welcome Melissa from Winnipeg. Hey, Melissa, welcome. Melissa, are you there?
Yes. Yes, hi. Hello.
You are on the air. Welcome to. Yes, I can. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Oh, thank you very much. I would just like to go back to the point of the blood type, being that there's so much talk about where does negative blood come from? Is it from this planet, etc.? Mr. Silverman or Dr. Silverman did not mention whether the blood was actually AB negative or positive.
As far as I'm aware, it hasn't been definitively said which rhesus group it is, but I'm not sure that how much significance or relevance the rhesus group would have. The main point is that it appears to be human blood. It appears to be blood that has occurred to stain the cloth as a result of the cloth wrapping the body of a man who had been tortured and crucified in the way that was reported to have happened to the individual known as Jesus of Nazareth.
All right. Thank you for the call, Melissa. Now, in terms of whether or not the image on the shroud is that of the historical Jesus, I believe that the image is somewhere between 5'11 and 6 foot. Now, based on the scant descriptions of Jesus Christ in the Bible, it doesn't say much. In fact, I think the Bible says that there was nothing remarkable in terms of the physicality of Jesus Christ. One would think that at that time, 2,000 years ago, if someone were walking around and they were 5'11", 6 foot, they would be sticking out like a sore thumb. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, as far as I understand, it was slightly less his height than that has been estimated from looking at the shroud. But I'm really not so sure that his height was really considered to be of much significance or would have drawn attention. I think the people that wrote about his life and what he said and what he did, they were describing the meaning of it rather than the appearance, and I'm not so sure that would have been something remarkable or worth mentioning. I mean, there's no mention of, as far as I'm aware, of anyone else's height.
The other question that has always sort of nagged at me is, and this is an ongoing debate, whether Jesus Christ had long hair or short hair. Recently, people have tried to recreate the face of Jesus, and we're told that, in keeping with custom at the time, he would have had short hair. And yet, of course, the image on the shroud, this individual has shoulder-length long hair. We also have, of course, Paul in the New Testament, I believe in the letters to the Corinthians, talking about how it was sort of an abomination for a man to have long or longish hair. So,
yeah.
How do we address that?
Well, I would say that if Paul did say that, then he's really just showing up his own prejudice and ignorance if he's trying to judge people by their appearance. And I don't think that would reflect. Remember, of course, Paul never actually met Jesus, of course. And wouldn't necessarily have known what he looked like if that wasn't really much of an issue that was described. People were really talking about what this man had done and what he taught rather than giving elaborate descriptions of what he looked like, I think.
All right, we're going to try to squeeze one more caller in, and we go to the first-time caller line and welcome Henry from Toledo, Ohio. Good morning, Henry.
How are you doing this morning?
Very well, thank you. Your question or comment for Dr. Andrew Silverman?
Yes. I'm a practicing Roman Catholic. I don't need things like the shroud to, be my faith, but I'm fascinated by it. And my question has to do with the photography of the shroud. I'm going to call the side A would be the side that actually contacted the body. And I take it that is what is photographed. Am I correct?
Yes. Yeah, generally that is what is photographed. That's the part that is on display. The side of the cloth that contacted both the front and the back of the body. And
Has anything ever been photographed from the opposite side, like shot through?
Yes, it has been. That has been looked at, and some people have asserted that there is an image on the other side of the cloth to some extent, but the jury is out on that one. And I personally, from looking at the evidence and seeing a very convincing paper that was presented at another shroud conference that was held in Valencia in Spain more recently, some research that was done by Dr. Di Lazzaro, and it appears to me to be a bit of a trick of the eye, so to speak, that what Dr. Di Lazzaro showed is how the human mind has a tendency to see patterns in things, and that there is some seepage of blood stain, but I'm not convinced personally, if you're asking me, about the evidence suggesting that there's an image on the reverse side of the.
All right, Henry in Toledo, thank you for your call. Dr. Silverman, I guess in conclusion, let me just ask you, then ultimately for you, what is the message that is encoded or embedded in the Shroud of Turin? What is the message for mankind? What's the takeaway?
For me, the takeaway message of this is that we, to understand the significance and value of every human being. After all, it was a human being that whose image is on the cloth. And remember that the image happened after the bloodstains and after he had died. And it points to, not in a physical sense of eternal physical life, but it points to the other evidence that suggests that man doesn't end when he dies, that the mind may well be something eternal, and that we can make that happen in the way according to how we live now.
Dr. Silverman, I appreciate your time tonight. Thank you so much. Dr. Andrew Silverman, thelightoftheshroud.com. My thanks to Lisa Lyon, Chris Boros, Tam Danheiser, George Norrie, of course, George Knapp, Tim Binall, Nathan Staten, Gina Salvati, Stephanie Smith, back here in Toronto at AM 640, Gord Harris, Scott Guest, and David Spargala. And of course, all of you at home, thank you for your ears. Good night.